Years in keeping this gadget. All right. So what I'm going to do for the next couple of minutes is field questions about the outline. And then we will turn to this argument because I think one of the helpful things that can happen for you is to watch someone present their own argument, watch them deal with objections, and see how well they engage in the rebuttal to an argument. So we will look at this one, and it was on the assignment for today, so you know that it was a 2004 piece in the American Journal of Bioethics, very controversial position that I took, which if we're going to try to figure out how strong an argument is, it should be controversial, because if it's sort of lukewarm and vapid and vanilla, well, there's not too much to defend there. But before we turn to that, let's look at the potential questions that have come now that you've had a week to think about the assignment. The first question that I was just asked was, I gave a sample outline, and it talked about having a certain number of pro arguments and a certain number of anti arguments, and in my sample, the anti PAS sample, I gave as a mock possible 4 arguments, I said, and then I assessed in that first paragraph their relative strength. So I said something like, 2 of them lend themselves to potential rebuttals. Am I anti or pro when I gave that? Which side are you taking?
Pro.
Okay. So I would say, I might have said something like, 4 of the anti arguments, though they have rebuttals, still raise serious concerns, but 2 of them actually are spurious arguments or not very substantial and don't raise significant concerns, very much do lend themselves to adequate rebuttal. What I want to tell you in that example, is that it is on your shoulders when you're dealing with the opponent how you are going to assess the relative strength or weakness of the various arguments you're entertaining. So what I tried to show you there was that you could make an assessment about the opponent and the relative size of the fruit, so to speak, of the various arguments you're considering. So you might say, and that was just one example, so if I said 3 arguments can be easily refuted and 1 raises serious concerns, or 2 raise serious concerns and 2 are easily rebutted, you could also say the only arguments I'm going to consider are the most serious arguments, and there are, and then pick your number, that's by your own lights, but let's say there are 2. They are both serious, but they do not outweigh the important benefits of legalizing PAS. In other words, the judgment is entirely yours about whether you think all of the arguments that you're engaging of the opponent are equally strong, whether you're only going to engage very strong arguments, or whether you're going to engage any arguments that your opponent is likely to present, because you're not going to argue, you know, you're not going to raise arguments that are trivial to your opponent, but the ones that your opponent puts a lot of stakes behind, you could argue that some of them are strong and some of them are not as strong. You could be fairly dismissive of some, but very respectful and awed in a way by others. So the answer to your question is, I gave you just an example of how you're supposed to give the relative weight in your eyes of the opponent's argument. They may all be strong, some may be strong, or you actually may think none of them are strong. If you think none of them are strong, let's say you think there's 3 arguments that your opponent is always going to want you to address and not one of them is strong, you can say that. Maybe at your peril, because then your opponent is kind of a dope. Some of them should be strong, or I'm not sure how much debate we actually have. So what I want to make sure I say in summary here is that that salmon-colored outline is merely a suggestion of how to deal with the various arguments as you see them. It is in no way a blueprint. It couldn't be, because I don't know how many arguments you're even going to see on the opponent's side, and I certainly don't know how many you're going to think are serious. So when I said one argument remains and needs to have serious consideration, that argument could be 4, it could be 3, or it could be 0. I have no idea. Does that answer the question?
Yeah.
It does. Alrighty, then let me turn to your question.
Okay. So my biggest question is, when you talked about the outline last week, your big focus wasn't consequential, so it was like the effect on society. But I found
or people.
Or people. So it can be the individual.
Absolutely.
You can say.
In fact, when it comes down to,
so you don't have to say because it's good for this person, it's good for society. I mean,
no.
So
let's think about consequentialism as a basket, two baskets, and you're going to load up anybody's interest and certain amount of weight per person and their interest or their perception of how much good they get. So let's imagine that I want PAS so badly and wanting something desperately, let's say, gives you 5 units of interest, or it's worth 5, that's why it's called utilitarianism, because they call them utils. So I get 5 utils of good for being able to have PAS when I need it, and that gets put in the basket, that's 5. And let's say there are 1,000 people who have 5 units of good. Now you got 5,000 units in the basket. Now on the other hand, it may be the case that every grandma that is coerced into PS, or every person who's not of means, or every person who is depressed, gets a -6 in utils, and there are 400 of them. Then you might have, and let's not worry about the multiplication of negative numbers, let's just say 400 times 6, which would be 2,500 instead of 5,000. So you've got 2,400 units of good in one side and 5,000 in another. We'd actually say one disutility in one side and 5,000 in another. I'm making a very simple equation. Only to point out that people for whom it's neither a good nor a disutility, like me when I'm healthy, I don't count at all. On the other hand, in consequentialism, things are always more complicated because I actually am feeling some disutility about the fear of not being able to access this while I don't need it. So I'm actually getting some disutility. I have some interest in being pro-PAS, even if I'm not desperate for the barbiturates right now. That has to count in the equation too. But it's in that sense that we're talking about society. In consequentialism, there can't be such a thing as society.
Right.
There's just the collection of people with their needs and their values and their interests and their harms and the benefits collected up. And what you're trying to do is figure out, is the need of some for this, and even the desire of others who don't yet need it but desire it, is that basket heavier than the bad things that would happen to some people, and even the concerns that others might have that might be more intangible disutilities or harms or costs, like, would we become a society that no longer tried to treat people and cure them at a certain age because we now have this standard option, like in Brave New World, where you off yourself at 60? Would that be a disutility?
So I guess the place that I get tripped up is like where that runs into crazy, like when we were talking about last time about we don't want Nazis in it and we don't want. So I guess that's where I was getting mixed up when I was writing it, is okay. Like, I'm not sure how to evaluate at what point.
Okay. Okay. And that is,
you know, I mean, they're not
that is the exact that is the exact conundrum of consequentialism.
Okay.
It's to try to think about how far down the pike, how improbable, how unlikely do you actually have to consider. So what you want to do is say to your opponent, or whichever way you are, how realistic is it by your lights? Now let's imagine, so let's have you, Rachel, you give me, how likely is that we will now stop treating people because the societal expectation in the United States of America in 2022 will be that you hit 60, you take the pill, even if you're not terminally ill. How likely?
That's not very likely.
All right, now what you wanna do is think about, does the smart opponent think that that's true? Then I would not even engage it.
Okay.
Now, if you said, well, you know what, actually, I think there is a watered down, a diluted version of this that is more subtle, but also more likely. And it might be that having to ask myself whether I should stay alive or not in terminal illness is a kind of burden for me. That in our society today, I don't have to ask myself, do I deserve to continue living these last 2 months? I have no choice If I'm not on a ventilator, if I'm not on a rest, you know, on a food and hydration, be in, as a life-sustaining therapy, I have no choice unless I want to shoot myself. But most people don't actually feel that they're up to getting a gun and putting it in their head and all this stuff, right? Most people don't feel that that's actually an option. So right now, I don't have to ask myself, do I deserve hospice? Of course I'm going to get hospice. What if I had to ask myself, should I go to hospice or should I take this option? It's like when you're thinking about any other tough choice. If, for example, you're in a society where you can't get out of a marriage, you don't have to ask yourself whether you want to get a divorce. You just can't get a divorce. Now, I'm not saying that we shouldn't be allowed to get a divorce, so be careful here. All I'm doing is metaphorizing, as they say in English. I'm giving a metaphor. But from the minute you live in a society with no-fault divorce, where it's your emotional stake, maybe it's your financial stake, but it is not your legal stake. It's not jail, it's not being stoned, it's not being shunned. Now, every time your marriage or your partnership is on the rocks, you actually have to ask the question, should I stay in this marriage? No one doubts, actually, that that is a kind of burden, not one that most people want to give back for a time when people, like in Louisiana, they wanted to make it that you couldn't actually get out of a marriage without this and that and years and all this, because they didn't want that to be a choice. They didn't want good marriages, decent marriages that could be saved, to just have people exiting all the time, which is what we've got now. You have a lot of times people who leave a marriage because you can, and things aren't so good, and it's an option. That, having an option, is a burden. I know I'm going on and on, but I'm trying to give you what a subtle version here would be. Right. A subtle version would be, is it going to be a harm for me to have to ask myself, should I stay alive in terminal illness? Now, let's say you say, that actually could be a burden. Then you'd acknowledge it and say, here is the credible concern that the opponents might raise. And while it is a concern, it's only a somewhat of a, it's a small probability, because we don't live in a country where suicide is really accepted in any other way. We also live in a religious country. But I will grant, if everyone had to make that choice, it would be a burden. But it would be a burden akin to, should I stay in this marriage when I have the option of divorce? And like marriage, you might argue, no one would want to go back to a time when we forbid divorce. And so we may not want to go back to a time when we forbid, or have a time when we forbid PAS, just because it is tougher to live more complexly or with more complex questions. That would be the long way that I would address a question that I think is fairly subtle. And I don't know if you have to, but I would not address the, we're going to all kill ourselves when we're 60 or just pop a pill and brave new world and so much.
And so it's up to us where we draw that line. Yes. And I need to convince you.
Yes. But that wasn't what you asked me in the email. You said you were having trouble with the off-limit versus consequence argument, and that's not that question. This is the question of how unlikely, how do I decide two things? What kind of opponent argument to consider? And we've talked about the ones that you think are the ones that a smart opponent, or the one that every opponent, either one would be your criteria. And then how do I mitigate it if there is a serious concern, but I don't think it trumps the others? But we haven't yet talked about whether you're struggling with the off-limit argument.
Yeah, so
I'm sure, oh, believe me.
So, like with the arguments that we brought up for pro in the last class, some of the stronger ones, like that some people want to have control over the time of their death.
Phrase like that, slam dunk, consequence inbound.
Okay, so.
Can I tell you the difference between what you just said? This is what she said. She said, I understand the claim. Some people want to have control over the end of life. She said, I understand that that is probably a consequence. And then she said, but how would I mess it up? How could I screw it up so that it actually was off limits?
Okay. Especially when you're giving, because it's easier for me to do that with my argument than it is when I phrase the opponent's.
Yeah, subject. Which side are you on?
I'm on pro.
Yeah, and that is the typical problem, and let me explain why. Because the off-limit arguments are the opponent of PAS sometimes has in his or her arsenal a whole bunch of arguments about how one ought not to kill oneself. One ought to respect human life. Right, because I know, 8 years I've been teaching this, and I have it nailed by now. Okay, good.
That's So laudatory about me, yes, it's laudable.
Okay. Take one piece at a time. If you said, we ought to have a right to control the time and manner of our death, it would be absolutely off limits. Because it appeals to the principle that there is some obligation we have to honor what people want. We have an obligation. It's a should. Thou shalt respect what others want. That's why we should give them PAS. All of that's off limits. That's completely deontological. That's completely principle-based. Because it doesn't say that's what people want. It doesn't say there will be a good consequence if people get it. It's very much in principle, like thou shalt not lie. Let's think about it like this. Maybe this will help, because a lot of you haven't had the spring class. And in the spring class, we tease this out a lot. Let's think of it like this. Thou shalt not lie. That's a deontological, in this case, it would be a completely off-limit argument. That's a principle. We should not lie. There's a duty not to lie. There's a prohibition against lying. There's many ways to phrase it, but it all adds up to the same thing. In principle, one should not lie. That does not actually show that lying has bad consequences in the world. In fact, if I said to you, do you think that I look slim in this outfit? And your actual view is, no, actually, it's not flattering. Okay? Right? Imagine that you were in that situation. And I say to you, do you think this makes me look svelte? Or do you think this is flattering to me? And you're now in a choice. She is my teacher. She looks very frumpy in this outfit. I know that there's a prohibition against lying. But on balance, there will be a lot more good in the world if I simply say, I love that outfit. And the fact that you have 14 pairs of pants that are just like this and you wear them every day, you've got it right. This is a good look for you. You should just keep on wearing it. Even that's not what you think. On balance, the world will be better off in this dyad for certain. It was not a good thing if she says I look chubby. It's not a good thing if she says I look frumpy. Not for her grade, not for my self-esteem, not for Ann Taylor, who gets a lot of money out of me. It's not good for anybody. So lying actually does some real good in the world sometimes. This is a paper about whether lying will do some good in the world, not about whether we ought not to ever lie. I don't care. Maybe we should never lie. But that's a separate question from, can it do some good sometimes? Yes, it can. So when you're thinking about a deontological prohibition about physician-assisted suicide, it could be the case we ought to be able to control our time and manner of death, but I don't know that that principle is true. What I do know is this, and maybe this is the way to think about it. Can you answer true or false to the question? If you can, it's consequentialist. Are there people who want to have control? Yes. Or let's phrase it in true or false. Is it true that there are people who want to have control at the end of life? Yes, it's true. Is it false that no one wants control at the end of their life? Yes, it is false. Then it's a consequence. Because you can have some opinions about whether it is true that there's a prohibition against lying. But when it gets down to real principles that are a little bit trickier, it's actually very difficult to know the truth and falsehood of those. They're pretty much all true. What kind of principle wouldn't there be? One should be courageous. Anybody going to fight with that one? No, of course you should be courageous. Yeah, absolutely. One should honor thy mother. Oh, yep, absolutely. Tell me a virtue, a principle, an obligation that you're not going to think. One ought not to harm small children. Yes, absolutely. So they don't lend themselves to true and false, but consequences, outcomes, cost-benefit analysis, they do. So you're asking yourself, can you concretely say the world will be better off or the world will be worse off by the action? If you're phrasing it like that, you're in land of consequence.
Can you say that there's something that would be an off-limits, like we were saying, is that some people believe you ought to value life.
Yeah, unfortunately, go ahead. So far as you put it, it's off limits. Okay.
So I was wondering,
yes, you can convert it.
By saying mm-hmm. some people think that you fit, like life is.
So the consequence would be that it will create fear in people that we will no longer respect life. It'll create a fear, for example, or it will make people anxious that we will no longer respect life. And they probably will, just like it makes people very anxious who believe that life begins at conception and who believe deontologically one ought not to have an abortion. It makes them very angry that abortion exists. It makes them very offended. It makes them, it has the consequence of making them very concerned for the unborn. That is all true. Does that mean that we shouldn't have abortion? I don't know, because we got to worry about their clear, sincere worry, fear, offense, and the benefits that accrue in a consequentialist formula that accrue to the woman or her future family or her future life for having an abortion. So we got to weigh it. Yes, there are people who are harmed psychologically or emotionally or offended morally, and that is a consequence. It's a consequence. Now, should it actually weigh in when someone's writhing in pain? I don't know. I mean, we upset each other morally all the time by simply just taking the opponent view. I mean, I'm morally upset, for example, if I'm a proponent, that I can't get access to PAS, or that my friends can't, or that people who need it can't. I am also got the consequence of being upset. So really, when it comes down to moral offense or fears, well, that's just what it means to have a serious controversy. Either way, you're going to have people feeling that, so don't they really kind of zero out? You know, doesn't that kind of cancel each other out? So there is a way to convert it, but once you've converted that particular one, I think you've got it even Steven on both sides.
So feelings are consequences.
Yeah, well, I don't know if they're good enough to get into this paper, but they are a consequence, for sure. Yeah. For example, if my daughter takes her jeans and sits with jeans on my new Pottery Barn bed frame one more time and puts one more scratch in the footboard, my feeling, the consequence will be a feeling of anger. Of course it's a consequence. Not only could it be, it is, I guarantee you. With all the 15 scratches on that footboard, with that $4,000 bed, I guarantee you I've had the consequence of the feeling of anger. Yes, feelings can be consequences.
People want control.
It was a brilliant example, but go ahead.
You know, like people want control over their body. The consequences, you know, loss of that reduces well-being.
Yeah, but it's all the same. It's all the same claim. If you're a proponent, your claim is there are people who very much want to have control of their body, and it will be a very negative consequence for them if they don't get to have that control, which is the current situation. It's the same claim. And it's true. It's about that. That is exactly what you're saying. It is a desire. It is what people want. And that is a consequence. It is considered a benefit. Okay. And it will be considered a denial of a benefit.
But that's a consequentialist argument.
Absolutely. Because it's not saying we ought to give people what they want. It's not saying we ought to prevent feelings of being denied. It's not saying anything about that. It's saying when people are denied what they want, there is a perception of harm to those who do not get it.
How, I'll take the part then because that's the one that I was writing on, but when you give your argument the for pro-PAS and you give your argument and then you give the opponent's objection and then you give your rebuttal, how are the argument and the rebuttal different? So I know they are, but...
Which section are you in now? Are you in your? Have you just defended your case and now you're moving on to engaging me?
No. So this is pro-PAS.
Pro-PAS,
so
and you're in your first
claim.
Section.
Yeah.
So your first claim is it will have the benefit of reducing pain and suffering at the end of life because people who can't get pain relief will have this as an option instead of being in pain.
Yeah.
I am basically mute as an opponent on that point. I can say there is palliative sedation. And that can take care of some of the people, put them under unconscious. It's also a small number, but I acknowledge what you're saying, that there will be some pain or some people will not want it. And you'll hit me back, and you'll say, in rebuttal, you'll say, I already did it because I was being gracious, but if I were just strictly speaking, just being the opponent, you would say, it will reduce pain and suffering. I'll say that there's palliative care, there's palliative sedation where you're unconscious, and only 3% will be. You can't have relief for narcotics. You'll say rebuttal, 3% is a large number, and palliative sedation for many people is just like death, except it prolongs the financial impact, it prolongs the emotional suffering of others, and there are some people who don't, who can't, it's not palatable to think about everybody standing around their bedside watching, so it's a different kind of harm.
Okay.
So you,
so you're
me,
responding
you.
Though to their, directly to their.
You are, I'm the opponent.
Sorry,
yeah.
I'm responding directly to your objection.
And
I'm
not nothing else.
What I said,
no. No, no, you got to take it further. Right, exactly.
Okay.
Otherwise, a philosophical debate would look like, I'm right, you're wrong, I'm right.
Yeah.
Right? And, okay, you know, well then let's go home. Right? I mean, you're trying to do some work here. You're trying to say, to my objection, how can I help Autumn see that her objection isn't as good as she thinks it is. Educate Autumn to help her understand why her objection isn't as brilliant as she just thinks, as she just thought. So you gotta take it deeper, you gotta hear what I say, and you've got to address it so that I can see the error of my ways. And still have self-respect, so you're not gonna make me look like a tummy, but.
Thank you.
All right, what else? Alrighty, so I'm gonna give us a little less light and then let's turn this. So, as I said, this is a very controversial argument, guaranteed to annoy half of you. But why else? What I want to do with this, of course, I think it's an inherently interesting topic, because obviously I wrote an article on it, so I thought so. But it's about a topic that isn't so timely anymore, because I kind of won the debate, in a way. Not because of the force of my genius argument, but because folks decided that that striking really wasn't the most effective or the most morally permissible way to deal with the crisis of the early 2000s and malpractice insurance. In other words, if this was just a winning strategy, the way it often is with the teachers union, then every time anybody had gotten any organization or any subspecialty in medicine got into some crisis, they'd just strike, right? But actually, this was a phenomenon in America at a very particular time, and I'm going to date it for you. And after that, there was a lot of flack, and there was a lot of debate, and nobody does it anymore. Physicians don't strike. I haven't seen it. Since this brouhaha, people took other avenues. I list, I don't know, four or five avenues that people should take to try to solve this crisis. That's what people did. They took those avenues instead of striking. You rarely see even a glimmer of a physician strike anymore. So in a way, this is kind of anachronistic. You know, this is taking us back into the ancient times of 2003. But I mean that a little tongue-in-cheek, but it's true that this is not a hot-button issue right now, like, well, what are the hot-button issues? The Texas Advanced Directive Law, or something that's very timely. This one has kind of just been settled, if not people saying, uncle to Autumn, yes, you win, simply by their feet, simply voting with their feet of not walking out. So in a way, the debate doesn't really rage. Nevertheless, it does seem to do just as much work when I present this paper of ruffling feathers, which is what you want if you're trying to teach argumentation, as it ever did, despite the fact that people really don't strike anymore. Feathers get ruffled when I say that people shouldn't strike, doctors shouldn't strike, so it'll probably work just as well as if you were thinking about striking or your organization or your hospital were. And what I want to do with this, given that it is anachronistic and not on anybody's agenda anymore, I want to use it to talk about how arguments get made and how they get defended, and how there are moments in an argument where the claims are very strong and the rebuttal's quite weak, and other times where you're on a little bit shaky ground and you know that you are, the rebuttals are pretty good, and you kind of have to say, well, that's a serious concern, here's how I would address it. But you're addressing it with a lot less chutzpah or confidence. So I want to use this to show moments in this argument where I feel like I'm on concrete, folks, bring it on, and other times where I feel like, you know, my opponent's got a point. I have something that I can say in response, but it could be maybe not the slam dunk of other moments. So even when you're giving a bioethics paper, even in published work, there will be times when you know that you've got a slam dunk, and other times when you know you're on a little bit of thin ice, but you still have a response, and that's okay. You can still make your argument knowing that you've got a combination, and this speaks to the question that we started the class off with about why did I put that on the outline about how, well, I can address three, but one remains serious. This is the exact same point. And there's nothing wrong with that. In fact, I've got one paper where I'd say there's probably two that I could point to if you're interested in them, where I feel like I can, I didn't say it there, my tone, though, was not as forceful and fist-clenched as it is in many other papers where I feel like I'm on solid ground, but I'll give you the name of two papers that I wrote where I knew that in one case, this was a quirky argument. Let's throw it out, see if it works. And in the other, this is the best argument I can come up with. I think there's some holes in it, but I think there's some potentiality in it. So the first paper is called Creating Fido's Twin, and it's a paper about pet cloning, where I argue that the rising status of pets in America and pet cloning as part of that might actually bespeak a kind of benefit that's accruing to companion animals, and maybe pet cloning, if it's part of that rising status where pets seem to be deserving more treatment, better treatment, might actually raise the status of animals, and on balance, pet cloning, like other types of veterinarian care, might actually be enhancing the treatment of animals. That's one paper in the Hastings Center. Another paper that I wrote for the American Journal of Bioethics, the same place this one went, was called The Presumption of Restraint in Animal Biotechnology, where I tried to use a virtue-based analysis to try to argue how we should look at biotechnology. And animal ethics is very tough because we don't have a universal agreement about what the status is of animals. So a lot of the attempts to figure out, well, what should we do with biotechnology are very, they fail miserably. So I tried something new. I tried thinking about whether there was a way in which there were things that we could agree on and think about animal biotechnology in the way that it would reflect on us if we did this rather than that. Again, I thought that my reach exceeded my grasp a little bit on that paper, but I gave it the old college try. So I wanted to show you these because one of the things that you sometimes see in other arenas where argumentation is the name of the game, like in law, is this almost an arrogant tone, as if where you're masking the fact that you may not have a winning argument, but you've just got to pound it to the prosecution or the defense or whatever case you're making, because otherwise you sort of weaken the ground you're on. That's the genre of legal debate. But that's not the genre of bioethics. So when you have a solid argument, absolutely fight hard. When you have a weaker argument, you might be better off saying, you know, that's a reasonable point. I think my response would be this. And that's what I think this paper can help us to show. All righty, so here we go. So definitely interrupt me, because this is a paper, or this is a discussion that is where I'm laying much more weight on what does argumentation look like, how do you go about it, where are the standards for objections and rebuttals, and how do you meet those standards, rather than can Autumn win the debate on whether physicians should strike, right? So let's just understand what our purpose is. And so if there's questions about either the content, that's fine, but also the form of the argument, definitely interrupt.
I just wondered if any of these groups had already gone through some of the other outlets you mentioned at the end of the presentation, like they'd already tried legislative action and gone to collective bargaining, done some of that. They felt this was last resort.
Well, they said that, but it obviously, I mean, okay, here's the sequence. They said we have no other choice. Some of them went on strike. Then they used those other choices and they worked. So I'm not sure what we want to make of the fact that they said, well, we had no other choice. Well, really, because the strikes didn't work, and then you did find some other choices. So of course they might have said that they weren't going to work, but in the end, obviously, they did work. Or at least they didn't work so poorly that they thought they should keep striking. Because right. This is actually, remember, or if you haven't read the paper, let me say it now. This is not a consequentialist argument at all. This is a deontological argument. I am actually not arguing that physician strikes can't work. I'm arguing one ought not to do them even if they do work. Parallel to what I talked about earlier with the lie and, you know, do I look, you know, frumpy in this outfit? if we are called upon to not lie, it doesn't matter that Autumn's feelings are going to be hurt. If you're not a consequentialist, then you have to just bite the bullet and say, well, thou shalt not lie. And unfortunately, you know, we could tweak it a little bit, Autumn, and then it would be flattering, or whatever you'd say that you could adhere to that duty. In other words, if there's a duty, and you are of the framework, your moral analysis says, I need to live inside that framework, then you simply have to adhere to your duties, even if the consequences won't be so good. This is a deontological argument, not surprisingly, because I am a deontologist. So if I were writing the PAS paper, I'd just have to suck it up and be a consequentialist like everybody else. But I am a card-carrying deontologist, and this is a deontological argument. So the argument form is this. Even if strikes do some good, we ought not to do them. That's what I'm arguing here. We simply ought not to do them. Just like torture might work, we ought not to do it. Okay, so this is a deontological argument. So to answer Joyce's question, I don't actually care if they would have worked. I think the evidence shows they didn't work. I think the evidence shows that there were other avenues. But I don't actually care, because I'm a deontologist, and I'm arguing we ought not to do it, and that's what I'm going to try to show. Which is part of the controversy, because half of the people in this room are consequentialists. So right out of the starting gate, my argument that even if it would do us some good, we shouldn't do it, already is ruffling feathers, because, and I respect that, because half the world's consequentialist and half is deontological. So if you're from the consequentialist framework, even the premise doesn't make any sense. What do you mean if it's not good for the world, we shouldn't do it? Why should we do it? So I'm already up against 50% of the people in the room just by the fact that I'm a deontologist. So, you know, there we go. All right, let me give you some background here. In July 2002, there was a strike by 150 surgeons. It forced Las Vegas only level 1 trauma center to close for 10 days. The closest level 2 trauma center was in Reno, which was 450 miles away, 10 days. Critically injured patients had to be airlifted to other states. In January 2003, so 6 months later, 24 surgeons in northern West Virginia went on strike. There were no trauma surgeons in the area's 4 hospitals. Most trauma surgery patients had to be transferred to hospitals 90 minutes away because of these strikes. In February 3rd, which is when I started to write this paper because I live in New Jersey, physicians all across New Jersey planned to do an open-ended statewide strike. No doctors at all in New Jersey. And the Medical Society of New Jersey, the general counsel who was the spokesperson, said, doctors are going out on February 3rd, and they're going to stay out until a reform package is adopted. It's as simple as that. The motivation for these strikes was malpractice rates, because malpractice rates were spectacularly unjust, outrageous at this time. And in some specialties, they are still quite serious, but at this point, they were rising so fast, faster than income, faster than inflation. The median malpractice insurance rates for orthopedic surgeons, and it all has to do with how much you get sued, because that's how they set the premiums, which was part of the problem. Instead of having it, here's all specialties together, let's have one pool of how we insure clinicians. Some specialties, like OB-GYN, which have very serious lawsuit rates, they had very high malpractice rates, whereas pediatricians rarely get sued, and so they had low malpractice rates. The percentage increased, depending on who the carrier was, in that year of 2003, 20 to 80%. You imagine a rate. If it's already 130%, it goes up 80% in 1 year. It was an outrage. So the question that I wanted to ask in this paper is, does that crisis, and no matter how many times I say in the paper and in presentations that I recognize it as a spectacular crisis, so it is a crisis. Does this crisis justify physician strikes? Paramount, and of course I'm loading it up here, but paramount to, if you are in a serious war that has threat to your whole population, does it make torture justified? Now, going on strike is not tantamount to torture, but it's got the same form of the argument. You can acknowledge that there is a terrible problem. What we're arguing about is, what is the solution? What's morally permissible to do in the face of a crisis? This is in no way torture. On the other hand, it's not nothing either, and that's what I'm trying to show. So let's look at the medical professional societies. Now, I don't go to these professional societies because I think that they have it right from God to the tablets. Of course not. But it does give an indication of where the field of medicine that thinks about its own professional ethics, where they came down and have consistently come down on the question of strikes. Because if anybody understands the consequences and also the moral duties, both, of striking and malpractice rates, it's going to be the people who dedicate their time to thinking about the questions for their profession. So I don't use them to say that they're infallible. I use them to say this was the decided view from these bodies that are very much interested in protecting their rank and file. These are physicians who are trying to uphold the profession, yes, to the highest standards, but also trying to protect their rank and file, their members. How about the AMA? Does the AMA think that physicians should strike against, should not strike? How about the American College of Physicians? That's the group that does Annals of Internal Medicine, very famous professional group. Against, absolute against. Now, how about the Medical College of New Jersey? The Medical Society of New Jersey. I just gave you a little clip. Approves. So there was some variation across medical bodies, of course, but the two big ones were decidedly against, even during this terrible crisis. So we can all go home. No, of course, because they could be wrong. So let's figure out whether New Jersey was right or the AMA was right. This is what the AMA said in 1999, so just a few years before. Obviously, he didn't have power to control what happened, but he wished that he did. So he was speaking more in the ought than in the will. Doctors will not strike or endanger patient care. We will follow the principles of medical ethics every step of the way. No other organization can make that promise to the patients of America and keep it. Of course, he couldn't get them to keep it, so that was a problem. But we do get his sentiment there. American College of Physicians in 2001, this is in Annals, and this is their position on physicians and walkouts and strikes. The college opposes joint actions by any physicians that would deny or limit services to patients, and that includes strikes, slowdowns, boycotts, and administrative or other organized actions that would harm patients. Decidedly against. But then we've got Rigolosi from the Medical Society. It's a desperate situation that we certainly understand from our colleagues out there, and we support their decision that the only way to bring it to the attention of lawmakers and the public was a work slowdown. There was just no other choice. So does it? You know I'm going to argue no, or we can, you know, wouldn't be fun. I'm going to argue there are three arguments. I am going to argue that it causes serious, that's what I mean by grave, and unique harms. And I can't attribute death as one of them. So death's off the table. Not one death can be attributed to a physician strike. So let me just tell you, you got that. If you're for physician strikes, let me just hand you that one right off the bat. No one died. I'm going to argue there are still a kind of serious harm. And I'm going to define harm. I'm not going to just let you define harm for yourself. I'm going to stipulate it. And then I'm going to try to say, here's what I think constitutes harm, and this is why I think strikes did cause harm. Two, I think they damage the patient-physician relationship. I'm going to argue that. And three, I think that they decrease the public's respect for the profession, the awe and the admiration that the public has for physicians. These are what I am arguing, and the style of the argument is a deontological argument. One ought not to strike because it causes harms. One ought not to strike because it damages the relationship. One ought not to strike because it decreases the public's respect. And so one ought not to create harms. One ought not to damage the relationship. One ought not to decrease respect. That's the style of this argument. That's the frame of it. It's deontological. And let's start with the first one. Okay. Now, obviously, the strikers were very self-reflective and folks with who took this very seriously, so they have a defense. The most dramatic harm, they might argue. So now I'm talking to my opponent. I'm laying out my opponent's position. And hopefully I have it captured correctly. The most dramatic harm would be death or permanent injury. That's what harm is, like the MD striker. To date, no physician strike has been shown to be the cause of any death or permanent injury. Therefore, strikes have caused no harm. So the style of their argument, my opponent says, harm is death or permanent injury. There hasn't been death or permanent injury. Therefore, there hasn't been any harm. It's a perfectly legitimate argument. It's just false. The problem, I'm going to argue, lies in the definition of harm. So I am already admitting to you that I am going to expand the idea of harm, not thinking that death isn't the most serious harm, but also arguing that things that fall short of permanent injury or death aren't trivial either. They are a kind of harm, a species of harm. Yes, of a lighter shade, that's red, and this is fuchsia or even light pink. I can even go with sometimes quite light pink. There's a spectrum of harm, and yet I'm going to argue we ought not to cause any harm when we're physicians, and so it's morally wrong. I think it's naive. That's not insulting. I'm not being ad hominem here. I'm going to try to argue that they have an inadequate definition, so I'm not arguing that the person, this is not an argument against the person, it's an argument that the belief is naive. It's too narrow. If I said to you, for example, you said to me, I have been harmed in by something, and I don't know what it is. I've been harmed because my $4,000 Pottery Barn bed has been scratched, and so I feel a kind of harm. Or my son's friend threw a Wii remote at my son, and he got a little tiny cut that won't result in a scar. He says that that's a kind of harm. Let's just think about those two kinds of harms. If somebody said, that's not harm, there was no harm there, where was the harm? I would say, well, it's not death, right? They'd say, well, did you die? No. Were you going to die because your furniture's all scratched? No. Okay. But does it mean that I have not in any way been harmed? That my son has in no way been harmed? No. It's naive to think that there's no harm in these lighter harms, lesser offenses, short of death. And I'm going to argue radically here. So I know that I am. Very controversial thesis. I'm going to argue strikes always cause harm. It's just a matter of what kind of harm. This is what I'm going to try to show you. It's always harm, somewhere on that continuum, from light pink, and we thank God no red, though the trauma surgery stuff in Reno, in Nevada, in Las Vegas, and West Virginia, I think they were playing with some fire there when trauma surgeons went out. They didn't, thank God, that nobody did die. But that was quite a continuum, and I'm going to argue even the light pink is harm and we shouldn't do it. Now here's how I'm going to go about it. I've made, philosophers love to do this. They name a little argument, so I'm going to name this one. I'm going to name it the argument from pre-strike goods and services. If a physician was gainfully employed, providing patients with quality service and care on the day before the strike, Tuesday, and would have provided patients with that same service and care on the day of the strike, tomorrow, Wednesday, if that person weren't striking, whatever doesn't get provided on Wednesday, presumably with a physician doing some good for somebody on Tuesday, well, then the lack of that thing on Wednesday will be a harm to the patient. That'll be an absence. At the very least, it'll be an absence. Unless there's somebody to replace that work, whatever kind of good I put out in the world, if I'm also supposed to put that good out in the world and somebody's supposed to receive that good in the world and there is no one to put out that good in the world, then whatever I'm not getting is a type of harm. That's what I'm going to argue. For all the days of the strike. At the very least, it's the absence of the good that you all as physicians provided to people when you were gainfully employed. They're only avoidable if there were enough physicians to cover all of the care of the striking physicians. Of course, if there were enough physicians to cover all the care of the striking physicians for longer than a few hours or a weekend or, you know, vacation coverage, then there'd have to be kind of a glut in the market of physicians, because otherwise, what would those replacement, you know, what are those people called in the strike? Scag, what are they called? The scabs, right. What were they doing with their time? Oh, I don't know. I took a couple of years off to, I don't know. What? I mean, there isn't going to be any surplus. But more importantly, and I want us to really think carefully about this one, if strikes didn't hurt, why would anybody do them? They're designed to hurt. that's what their goal is. It's not that harm is, well, it's an unfortunate, unavoidable kind of byproduct, you know. It's why you do it. Now, I don't mean that you are targeting, that you are hoping that bad things happen, but let's think about any strike at all. Why do teachers strike? I mean, we know that the underlying motivation is always money, so it's about money. Sometimes it's working conditions, and I'll give you an example where some physicians actually went on strike at the University of Chicago, one of their hospitals, and it wasn't for money at all. And that's a very different case, I think. But let's think about why teachers strike or automotive workers strike. What the purpose is of the mechanism of the strike as a strategy. It's to make somebody feel the absence of their work. So, for example, if it's teachers not teaching, it's the threat that all of these children and the parents getting very nervous about them having to go to school long in the summer, or their children just not getting educated if it goes on so long that they can't make it up. They are trying to inflict a kind of harm on the populace, the harm of denying their service that is very much needed so that either children won't get educated or the year will extend into the summer and that will infringe on the vacations and the parent schedules and camps and all of that. With automotive workers, who are they trying to hurt? They're trying to hurt the pocketbooks of the people who run the company, because for every day they don't make a product, that's a day that product then can't turn into commerce and make money for the company. So they're trying to harm the company in the short term to have them make less money so that they can reap more decent wages so that they can participate in that. But the idea is, I'm going to do it with the mechanism of giving you a pinch. If I'm not trying to pinch you, then I don't do a strike. I do something else. I negotiate, for example, but I don't strike. The only reason you strike is to give somebody a pinch. If you're pinching somebody, unless you haven't been pinched recently, you will know pinching is a harm. Pinching hurts. Now, how much of a harm? Well, it is a lot better to be pinched than have somebody hack off your arm. I'm going to grant that. That doesn't mean that a pinch is something that is not a hurt or a harm. It's why you do it. You do it to pinch. Now, what kind of harms? Because nobody died. Well, routine care, which you can say, well, that's not that much of a harm. Well, maybe your life is organized such that if you miss an appointment that is for routine care and you have to reschedule it, maybe it's very easy. With my primary care physician, you're looking at about a 9-month wait for a true checkup. The full checkup. If you need an acute care appointment, you can get in faster. But if you want a checkup, you're looking at somewhere between a 6 and a 9 month wait. So if she's on strike the day of my appointment, which right now is December 9th, I don't know. I mean, it means I might be in another 6 month wait. And routine care for some people with some illnesses, it's not just an inconvenience. Elective procedures are another kind of harm. And I'm going to give you a case in a second about procedures that don't have to be done today. Your endoscopy, your mammogram, or even more invasive elective procedures, your colonoscopy. But it doesn't mean that you're not suffering in some way by not having them. Continuity of care. In some specialties, in some patient-doctor relationships, the continuity of provider is actually something very meaningful for you. For example, I like to see our pediatrician. I know there's probably other very qualified pediatricians in the practice, but I want my pediatrician, the one who knows my kid's history, the one who has a relationship with them, and the one who doesn't scare them, the one who doesn't scare me. I mean, I want continuity of care, and if I don't have it, there is a harm. Certainly there's a harm to my kids if they don't have the continuity of care. They don't want to see some stranger. Accessibility of care. I mean, you think about that case in Las Vegas where people were airlifted. That's a problem with accessibility of care, and as a harm. Of course, I understand that you've got a rejoinder ready for me. If all the physicians leave Las Vegas, you'll sure as hell have some accessibility of care problems. That is a nice rejoinder. It doesn't mitigate the fact that you're actually harming somebody by removing the access in a situation like this where you are intentionally doing this to cause harm. Let's look at a case. Mary's a 65-year-old New Jersey resident suffering from crippling arthritis. It took her 2 months to get on the schedule for her second knee replacement, and she's counting down the days until the surgery. The Vicodin she is taking is not controlling her pain. She's heard about the impending strike involving her hospital and is becoming anxious that her elective procedure, her knee replacement, might be postponed. She's getting depressed thinking about having to live with this pain much longer. There are real people who are having real harms because of even impending strike, let alone a work stoppage. And now my argument about how to defend that. So I've tried to make the case there are going to be harms. Maybe light pink, maybe deeper shades, but there's going to be harm. But okay, so what? Well, the first principle of medicine is primum non nocere, do no harm first, do no harm, and physician strikes harm patients. It violates one of the basic tenets. It's what people swear they're not going to do. In fact, it's the reason that they say they're not going to do things like PAS. PAS, if you say to a physician who's against PAS, why don't you think we should legalize PAS, that person is going to inevitably say back to you, because it would cause harm, and I've taken an oath, I adhere to the moral prohibition against causing harm. So I am arguing that physician strikes cannot be ethically justified because I think it's incontrovertible that they cause at least some types of harm, and there is an oath that folks take to say that they will not harm. So my first argument is, yep?
In your paper, you said you're supposed to do like point and then counterpoint, your point and then, you didn't really go back and rebut some of those individual arguments.
There are two styles. It's a great question. There are two styles of how to deal with the opponent. Lay out your whole case first and then entertain objections, or lay out an argument, deal with an objection. Lay out an argument, deal with an objection. And that is, there are two different styles. The task that I've given you is, I've made a decision for you because most people in the class will be new to argumentation. It takes a lot more finesse, a lot more skill, to handle objections at the end and still make sure you're actually entertaining everybody's objections. It takes a very controlled hand. So what I'm afraid of in this little mini exercise, which for some people is their first instance out of the starting gate, I'm afraid they'll botch it up. Because you have to know in the back of your mind, what are the opponent's objections? Like you saw me, I just said, now there's gonna be a rebuttal that comes to this. I already know when I'm at this part of the argument that there's going to be a rebuttal. And PhD later, 40 publications and a PhD later, you probably will trust that I will make sure I entertain those objections, because if I don't, you're not going to be sold. So you can trust that I'm going to get to them. But I'm not sure I can trust people who have just started. They may gloss. And even a veteran can gloss, but you don't want to gloss. So for example, it would be very convenient for me to simply leave out any of the tricky arguments you might have against me. And I'm the one in control here. It's my paper. You're the passive listener. You can't, in this class, you can raise your hand, but in the piece that you're reading from AJOB, there's nothing you can do but seethe and steam. You can't actually talk to me in any meaningful way. You could write to me or whatever, but while you're reading that paper, we're not in dialogue. So, one of the things that the powerful person in argument can do is just leave out the tough arguments. In fact, I can entertain only weak arguments, and then it's called entertaining straw man arguments. I make a person out of straw, and then it's surprisingly easy to knock it down. That's what a straw man argument is. So it is true that what I've asked of you is to address them right there. That's because I want to make sure you don't fall into the trap of eliminating some powerful rebuttal that somebody's got. And that's usually what happens. It seems to me for folks who are fairly new to this genre or this way of thinking, that I'm sitting there as the reader with rebuttals ready to fire. I'll be patient if people would actually get to them at the end. They don't. They just gloss. But in this paper, you're right. That this is a style that I decide I'll present my whole case, and then I'll collate all of the objections and deal with them at once. It's an absolutely legitimate decision to make. You could make it in this paper too, but you just have to make sure, you know. The other thing is, I am only presenting my own side right now. This is my side, and then I'm going to present your side. It's a lot worse for me to present your argument and not give you gesture at your argument, but not give you full voice to articulate your own position in that argument. So if I said something like this, some people want to bring up, if I said at this point in the paper, some people will want to bring up that it'll be harmful if they can't get access at all. Yeah, that's true, but second argument. That's not enough treatment. So you have to actually, if you're going to gesture at somebody's argument, you have to actually go through it. In a presentation, I can say to you, just hang on, I will get to the argument. I will get to that rebuttal. But in a paper, that's very hard to do. All right, second argument, I'm going to argue that physician strikes damage physician-patient relationships. I'm going to read from the AMA code here, the fundamental elements of the patient-physician relationship. The patient has the right to courtesy, respect, dignity, responsiveness, and timely attention to his or her needs. And the patient has the right to continuity of health care. I had mentioned that as one of the harms. The physician may not discontinue treatment of a patient as long as further treatment is medically indicated without giving the patient reasonable assistance and sufficient opportunity to make alternative arrangements for care. There were a lot of things in the fundamental elements of the patient-physician relationship document that the AMA laid out, but I'm going to focus only on two because I think that these two are the most relevant. And I'm going to argue that whenever either one of these two is violated, the patient-physician relationship is damaged. So let's talk about the first one. It thwarts the right to courtesy and respect by violating an implicit contract. When appointments are scheduled, physicians enter into a contract with patients. And these are a species of a kind of promise. I make an appointment for my yearly exam. It's December 9th, and my physician promises that she will be there. Now, of course, patients always recognize justifiable reasons for breaking a promise. If, for example, let's say it's an OB-GYN kind of appointment, and the OB-GYN promises to be there on, you know, whatever, November 3rd, but on November 3rd, there is some case she didn't or he didn't expect that some woman who's delivering or is in some kind of pregnancy crisis or who knows what, and she's stuck in the hospital the entire day. My reaction to that is, yeah, I'm sorry that it's inconvenient for me, but I totally don't blame her. There is no moral blame or culpability when there's a justifiable reason for breaking a promise. The contract that you make with patients is, I will treat you unless there's some reason, some life-threatening or very important reason why I can't honor your promise, and then I will honor it, but at a later date. We understand that there has to be triage, even in these kind of circumstances, and we understand that in daily life. If I make a promise to be at the movie theater with you and I am late because I'm giving CPR at some accident, you can be frustrated, but you certainly don't blame me. You understand. It's called an excusing condition. There are always excusing conditions, and this is one. I recognize that you may not be able to keep that appointment. But let's talk about why I think you can break the appointment. This is justifiable reasons. That's how we think about them. What reasons could you justify to your fellow human beings? And one that we know you could justify to everyone is somebody's life is in danger, somebody's pregnancy is in danger, somebody's in a crisis of some sort. Those are always reasons that rational human beings understand. And I don't mean the irate person who can't understand. I mean the masses. We get it. But justifiable reasons never include pure self-interest. They always involve some other obligation to some other. Let's imagine, for example, that I promised to meet you at the movies, but then I got a better offer, somebody who was better looking or more interesting, so I decided not to meet you at the movies. I didn't tell you, I just didn't show. Because it served my interest to just, you know, be a no-show, stand you up. Is that a justifiable reason? It is not. I'll give you a more concrete case. My daughter needed to get her cast off. She had a growth plate fracture, and so it's very hard to get a pediatric orthopedic surgeon appointment, and she had been counting down the days. She's 10 of these, I think it was 4 weeks that she had to be in the cast. So it was very difficult. There was nobody at CHOP who could see her on the day she was supposed to get the cast off. We live in Princeton. The pediatric orthopedic surgeon was going to take the cast off on that Tuesday. She was counting down the days because she couldn't swim, she couldn't go to the beach. Her whole life, her whole summer was disrupted by this cast not being able to get wet and ruining her summer. So she's counting down the days. And the day of our appointment was the day that New Jersey had a lot of flooding. So the orthopedic surgeon decided that instead of, and it was the day after this flood, so instead of being there to take my daughter's cast off, she decided that she was going to attend to some of the property damage of her house. And frankly, I have to tell you, I did not find that to be a justifiable reason at all. She could hire someone, she could attend to it. It would be different if all the walls were caving in, but she's got some water in her basement, and my daughter has to be in a cast for another week so that you can attend to your basement. I feel that that is not a justifiable reason. Now, if I'm just the crazy mom and you think it is a justifiable reason, that's when we have a debate. I felt that she shirked her obligation to my daughter by placing her own pure self-interest. I understand she had to make a couple of calls. I'd understand if there was a wait while she got whoever she needed into her McMansion to get her water out of her basement or whatever. But my daughter being in a cast for another week for her basement, I did not think was fair, given that my daughter was 10 and vulnerable and there was nobody else. Now, you could think that is a justifiable reason, because what I'm showing you is there's a little bit of eye of the beholder here. Maybe you think it's totally reasonable that she canceled appointments for this, and maybe you don't think it is. I am arguing that on pure self-interest, self-serving, when there's an obligation to patients, you're not able to break it. Now, if your life is in danger as the provider, absolutely you have the right. In other words, it isn't pure self-interest if your life's on the line, or if your children's life is on the line. That's not pure self-interest. That's we have an obligation to protect our bodies, to protect our loved ones. And that I would find fine. If the reason was that her daughter had an appendicitis, so she had to break my daughter's appointment for her daughter's appendicitis to be at the bedside, that would seem totally reasonable to me. Now, you are different, and you may find there are other that this is justifiable in a way that I don't think it is. But then you'd probably have to give me some explanation for how it's not just self-interest. Because typically, when we have a moral obligation to someone else, we allow them to break that moral obligation because of another moral obligation that is more pressing for that individual. But that one has to deal with some of the inconveniences and expense, yes, of dealing with some flooding, to me doesn't seem like a moral obligation. Whereas if her daughter was trapped in the basement, of course she should be breaking the appointment to my daughter. So that's how I'm arguing about justifiable reasons. And I'm arguing not that self-interest is never justifiable, but that self-interest to trump a moral obligation is not justifiable. And strikes are based on income. Strikes are done to protect one's wealth. And I am arguing that's not a justifiable reason to break promises to patients. Though that doesn't mean that we ought not to care about our own self-interest. We should. So I am not saying that they should just sit by passively and let their incomes go down the drain. Absolutely not. I'm arguing that they should try to figure out a way to protect their incomes without actually thwarting obligations to their patients. That's what I'm arguing. When strikes cause physicians to cancel appointments, a promise is broken to a patient on grounds of self-interest. When promises are broken out of self-interest, the victim, the person who's on the receiving end, feels that they have had a lack of respect or courtesy. That's what I felt when I found out that she was attending to her household concerns rather than her patient obligations. I did not feel that my daughter's condition had been properly respected, and I absolutely would have if she had been ill, if her family had been ill, if there was some other pressing patient need that was more serious than my daughter's growth plate problem. And the result of feeling this lack of respect and basic courtesy, and I can attest to this, and again, I'm not saying you may disagree that it was a violation. What I'm now going to argue is, if I feel a lack of respect, it damages the patient-physician relationship. I actually despise her. We don't go back. I feel that I can't trust her again. If that's what it takes, it's how little she understood what it meant to have a cast for my daughter, and the suffering that went into that, our relationship has been severed. And so when I found out she canceled it, I just rescheduled with someone else. So what I'm arguing is, when you feel, I don't mean that people in the room may disagree, say, boy, Autumn, as a mother, she just totally overreacts. Yeah, that may be true. But when you feel a lack of respect and courtesy, the relationship has been severed. And the only way to get that relationship back would be a sincere apology, which, since she thought she was fully justified, was not forthcoming. So that the patient-physician relationship can be permanently damaged. If you don't feel respect in and that your concerns were taken seriously, that there was an unjustifiable, in your light's reason, then there's two options. You can explain to me why it was justified, and perhaps I will see it your way. Perhaps I will be like, wow, I didn't realize it was that serious, and you know, I didn't realize that your dog was trapped there in the basement. I love dogs too, or whatever it is. You can try to explain it to me and justify it, or basically, you know, we're kind of done. Even if we continue our relationship, it's never the same. Now, the striker's potential defense. The malpractice insurance fees are so high that we may be forced to leave the area in which we practice. This was the rebuttal I promised that I would engage, causing even more disruption in patient care. Thus, we should not be condemned by patients for canceling appointments and surgeries because of our collective action. It will actually provide for long-term care. That's a consequentialist argument. This is a classic consequentialist argument. I'm going to give a little bit of hurt now to get a better gain later. I'm trading off some costs for a bigger benefit. And I'm not even disputing that if they don't get the malpractice rates, some people will leave. There's no doubt about it. Malpractice rates shifted full, it determined whether people stayed or left certain areas, and it even determined what part of certain specialties people practiced in. For example, a lot of you already know this, it is so much cheaper to practice gyne than OB-GYN. If you take the OB out of OB-GYN, your insurance practice, your insurance rates will go down. So there were people who simply left obstetrics for just gynecology. So it isn't that it has no implications or bad consequences, it does. Now my rejoinder. It's a crisis. Rates are too high, lawsuits are often unfounded, jury awards are ridiculous, they can be very, very overinflated. There's a lot of emotion, not so much justice. There is a very legitimate complaint here. On the other hand, it is important to keep perspective, I think, on U.S. earnings. So I want to show you something about U.S. earnings. The median income in the United States for a family of four is $50,000. At least it was in 2000. It's probably a little higher now, though we had a recession. The median income in Pennsylvania for a family of four is a little bit higher, $65,000. Family of four, median income, $65,000. Median, most of you already know this, means 50% or below that. 50% of Americans make $50,000 or less. 50%. 150 million people. The median income of orthopedic surgeons, and this is a very hard figure to get, so it could be a lot higher than this. $260,000. And that would be people who are practicing orthopedic surgery in Montana, not BBB and BBB over at Pensy, you know, one of the most famous orthopedic surgery departments in Philadelphia. So this is median. And that's the fact, this is as close to a fact as I could get on it. If we think about the median income of orthopedic surgeons, even if we use the median income in Pennsylvania, orthopedic surgeons are making four times what 50% or more families are making. A household income of $250,000 puts one in the top 3% of U.S. households. Now, I know that many of you in the room, and maybe me included, don't think $260,000 is really all that much annual income. And I understand that perspective. I might even share that perspective. But when I do share that perspective, I try to remind myself that that income puts one in the top 3% of U.S. households. In other words, what we do have to understand is how much of that income is going to be eaten out by malpractice insurance. We absolutely have to think about that. But we are already talking about people who are some of the highest earners in America. It doesn't feel like it's that much money because the top 3% of American earners goes from 250,000 to billion. It's an unbelievable spectrum in that top 3%. But 97% of Americans make less than this. A household income of $160,000 puts you in the top 20%. So I think one of the things that has to be engaged here is how much physicians in certain specialties are actually bringing in. And then, of course, we have to think about it relative to the malpractice rate. So to try to justify to patients that you're canceling their appointments because you need to protest that you don't earn enough money. Now, if you make $250,000 and you have to spend $200,000 in malpractice insurance, you actually are only yielding $50,000. And no American thinks that an orthopedic surgeon should make $50,000. That's not just either. It just takes too long to train. And that's one of the rebuttals you're going to get here, is that the training costs a lot of money. It costs a lot of money and it takes a lot of time. And it's very valuable work. So Americans aren't actually usually complaining about the salaries physicians get. They complain about other kind of salaries, but not usually physicians. But one thing that's interesting is, in all the conversation that went on around strikes at this time, there was none that I could find where people were actually saying, this is how much I make, this is how much my malpractice is, this is the difference. The only number that physicians seemed willing to share was the rate of malpractice. Now let's imagine that your malpractice rate is $130,000. Let's say that's the top amount of money, $130,000. And you make $1 million. Well, jeez, you're still making quite a bit. On the other hand, if you've got the very highest malpractice rate of 130, or let's say the median, and you're making 260, you're only clearing 130. And that doesn't really seem enough, that you wouldn't be in the top 20% of American earners for all of the time that it takes to be this specialty. But my point is that if you're going to justify needing to stop work on me, needing to break promises to me, then you need to justify it. And the way that you can justify it is to have an honest discussion about how much this is actually amounting to. Because it's not actually enough to cite the malpractice rates. What you need to say to the American people is, not this is what my malpractice rate is, but this is what I make after malpractice. And that's part of the discussion that people weren't willing to do. Now, part of the reason they're not willing to do is because nobody wants to talk about their income, right? Money, sex, religion, that's what you don't talk about in the United States. So I understand that. On the other hand, it does raise the concern about maybe though that folks didn't want those numbers actually out in the world. Because maybe people would be a little bit less sympathetic when 50% of Americans make $50,000 or less. Maybe they're not going to be that supportive if you're only making $180,000 or $250,000. I don't know. So part of the problem here when you're trying to justify to somebody is that you got to justify with some real facts. Is it the case that there were some people whose malpractice rates were very, very high and whose income wasn't so high? Yeah, like you think about, you're starting OB-GYN with a very high malpractice rate, and that could really be giving somebody the shaft. But it wasn't really the starting OB-GYNs who were actually doing the protesting. It was mostly the senior orthopedic surgeons or the senior trauma surgeons. And for those people, we would really need to understand, maybe not the actual number, but something like this. With the malpractice rates I've got, I'm only going to be making in the top 20% of American earners, and I really should be making in the top 3% of American earners. Something like that. We have to understand a little bit about what are we talking about here. Because one of the things we do know is that many physicians, certainly once they get to be senior physicians, do live very, very well. So, and I'll give you an example of this. I went to an awards banquet at HUP, and HUP physicians are actually ceilinged a lot of times. They're salaried, so they're not in private practice where you've got the sky high BBB and BI. You probably can't even count as high as those folks making that famous orthopedic surgery practice. So, but at Penn, they're salaried, so you're not going to go crazy like that. All right, nevertheless, and that's why it's a good illustration, because these aren't going to be the wealthiest doctors by far. Nora and I went to one of the every year, somebody from this department has to go to the annual awards banquet, where we're mostly ignored, but it doesn't matter, because we're not MDs anyway, but we still have to go, and it was at the Four Seasons. So Nora and I were waiting for the valet to bring the cars. And I'm not kidding you, Beamer, Mercedes, Volvo, Jaguar, Beamer, Mercedes, 1994 Camry. Come on, Nora, it's time to go, right? So in a way, I do hear it. I do hear it because as I said, we know that there are OB-GYN cases, for example, of starting salaries here, malpractice insurance going like this, and really not making a decent income. There is no doubt about it. But what we didn't get in this crisis was a good understanding of how many cases were like that, and how many were, you know, I really love to have the $3 million house in Princeton, now I can only have the $2 million house in Princeton. And that, Americans would have been a lot less supportive of. And I don't know which case, because it is extremely hard to find income about physicians. All right, all of that was to say that I might be able to be justified, because absolutely I don't want physicians making pittance for all of the training that they've got. On the other hand, American salaries in general are pretty darn low, so to justify harming me, I need to be brought on board with some real facts. In fact, I might even support you. I might even say to my beloved, let's say, pediatrician, if he's going to make pittance after the malpractice, I might say, you know what? I think you should go on strike. I believe in your cause. Just like a lot of times I support, Princeton teachers don't usually strike, but that's, you know, because Princeton basically just keeps voting up the school budget, and so do I. But let's imagine that they don't, right, for one crazy day. I'd probably say, you know what? You all do such a good job in that classroom. The Princeton Public Schools, I just totally stand behind it. I'll protest with you, right? So you might actually get the public on board if they support the cause enough, even though it's ultimately trying to pinch somebody. I might say, you know what? It's not going to pinch me. I stand with you. And if there were real compelling cases of this, people would have stood with them because they are very loyal to their own practitioners. Okay, the next one is expectation of non-abandonment. Strikes thwart patients' expectations of non-abandonment. As a patient, I have a right to expect my physician to treat me, or if that's not possible, to aid me in securing treatment somewhere else. But during a strike, my physician severs that. My physician says, I'm not going to be there for you. Well, who's going to be there for me, doc? No one. That's the whole point. Nobody's going to be there for you. But what about me? What about the fact that you said that you wouldn't abandon me and when I needed you? And this concern applies to both long-standing and acute patient relationships. So even if I've been seeing an orthopedic surgeon who scheduled my hip replacement and goes on strike, I've been abandoned. I counted on you being there, and now you're not going to be there. And you're doing this for what reason? Or I'm a trauma patient, and I'm in need of an orthopedic, I'm a trauma patient, and I need an orthopedic surgeon. But then my community's been abandoned since we rely, it's not personal, the entire community's been abandoned because the entire trauma surgery staff has left for this strike. So now it can be personal, or it can be just sort of, our whole community's been abandoned with this specialty. I'm arguing that physician strikes undermine the expectations, both by thwarting patient respect and causing a patient abandonment, both problems. And then finally, I'm going to argue that physician strikes decrease the respect for the profession. Now, of course, for me to make this argument, you'd actually have to think that the American public holds the profession in very high esteem. I believe they actually do. Certainly, we are in a time when patients want to have more of a shared responsibility for their care with their physicians. So it isn't the same pedestal that we have in the generations above me, like my mother-in-law, who doesn't even think she has to say Dr. Smith. She just calls her physician doctor, like father in the priesthood. That's how much she reveres her physicians. And I don't actually call my physician doctor. Especially if they're not going to say, well, doctor, how are you feeling today? Well, doctor, I'm glad you're treating me. Unless we're going to go doctor both ways, then no. But I still believe that physicians are held in very high esteem, and I think they deserve that high esteem. And this isn't hard to test because sociologists are all over this. They do these things like they're called status measures, and they do poll data. They have survey data that looks at how Americans rank by prestige and status various positions. various professions. So, for example, the highest status position in the United States is the Supreme Court Justice. It's all downhill from there if you can get that job. But then it goes down. And this is a kind of funny anecdote, but when I was at Harvard in the sociology PhD program, I was a stratificationist, which meant that I looked at status, race, class, gender, sexual orientation. That was what I did. And I looked at the status data, and I realized that sociologists actually had a much lower status than philosophy. I was out of there and do a PhD in philosophy. It wasn't my only motivation, but I thought, well, now maybe there is something to this. So I didn't feel sociology was quite the right fit for me. But it's I'm telling this as sort of an amusing anecdote, but there really are status measures, even of faculty. So economists, for example, are and mathematicians, physicists, philosophers tend to be some of the highest status of profession of professors. And sociologists and communications and some of the others are lower, which is not a reason to pick a job, but I'm just throwing that out there. Doctors always rank very, very high on these status measures. Okay, so I'm arguing that physicians are held, actually, because of this status, to higher ethical standards than other professions. They are seen as having a calling. And while you might poo-poo that, they actually make a whole lot of this when they do, for example, the white coat ceremony. Everybody gets their white coat and starts talking about one of the O's, you know, at the beginning and the end of medical school. And I believe that strikes are not compatible with this noble purpose. That doesn't mean that physicians shouldn't make a very, very, very good salary. Of course they should. And it doesn't mean that they shouldn't fight unfair malpractice rates. They should. What I'm simply arguing is that strikes undermine the status and the respect that patients have. And that's something I think that physicians should not tamper with. Medical profession enjoys one of the highest status, and they are granted this because they are seen as having a purpose of serving humanity. It's you know, you think about the in a crisis when there's an epidemic. People expect doctors to be in the hospitals, even in an epidemic, even H1N1. People expect them to be in the hospitals and treating the patients. And they expect that of themselves. And for that, like firefighters and police officers, there is a higher kind of respect for them. And imagine if your firefighters decided to go out on strike. The noble purpose is exemplified in the oaths that they take upon entering the profession. And here are some: the physician's oath, the oath of Maimonides, the modified Hippocratic oath. I mean, look at this, that people take this very seriously, and I do too. I solemnly pledge myself to consecrate my life to the service of humanity. People actually say that. They say it right out loud. They say it right at the beginning of medical school. Or, O God, that thou hast appointed me to watch over the life and death of thy creatures. Here am I, ready for my vocation, that I turn into my calling. Or the modified Hippocratic Oath, now being admitted to the profession of medicine, I pledge my duty to those trusting in my knowledge or training. I am arguing that strikes are unbecoming to a profession that thinks of themselves and is seen in them this way as having a calling, just as it's unbecoming for priests or other clergy or firefighters. And I think it calls into question the commitment to serve. There's a self-serving, which doesn't mean that you shouldn't be interested in your own economics. I'm interested in mine. I expect you to be interested in yours. But the self-serving nature of a strike, with its consequent harms, conflicts with the self-sacrificing image of the devoted physician. You think about the change in reputation when public school teachers did begin to strike. They weren't seen as the same caring, vocation-based profession that they had before they were unionized and went on strike in this way. I think they dethrone physicians. I think they make them seem ordinary at best and possibly, depending on the incomes we're talking about, greedy or selfish at worst. It was those kind of words, selfish, for example, that I saddled that pediatric orthopedic surgeon with when she took care of her house instead of my daughter's ankle. I thought of her as selfish, as self-absorbed, and as irresponsible. Strikes hurt the reputation and image of the medical profession, in my view, and a significant change in public perception, actually, if I put a little parenthesis in, could have far-reaching consequences. One of the reasons, I mean, remember, how do we get incomes the way that we have them? Because somebody thinks it's worth paying that much for. Doctors in other countries don't make this much money. I can't think of many places where doctors make this much money, as a matter of fact. So my conclusion here is that physician strikes harm patients, they damage the relationship between patients and their physicians, and they decrease the public's respect for the profession, and I'm arguing they cannot be justified. Well, then what do I think is the proper response? Because while we have obligations in our professional life to other people, we absolutely do, and we can decide how much or how little, what the implications, we also have a right to care about our own income. And this was not trivial. So what I argued here was that there could be collective bargaining that doesn't include strikes or boycotts, that's one thing. They could work on legislative action, grassroots organizing, involving the patients actually, or publicity. These were actually a lot of the things that were tried. In other words, think about the strategy like this. You have a whole bunch, you have an entire country that reveres the work you do, many of whom have very good relationships, very close relationships with their treating physicians. If the treating physicians, instead of saying, I'm going to deny you, the public, my service and give you a pinch, if instead of that they said, they appealed to the public, for example, by notices in their office that said, you know what? I'm really nervous. I'm not sure I can stay here any longer. My malpractice rates are too high. I would really appreciate if you wrote your congressman, or if you came with us when we did a Saturday afternoon, you know, demonstration, or if you, other kinds of support. You wrote articles or newspaper editorials. If you brought patients on board to support the injustice that is really the case with high malpractice rates, then you wouldn't have had to, the physicians wouldn't have had to pinch them, and they might actually have gotten a whole groundswelling of support. So that's what I mean about actually involving the patients. Legislative action, you don't actually have to leave, you don't have to actually have to pinch patients by not being there to deliver babies. You can simply say, the malpractice rates in this area are this high for OB-GYNs, the average salary for OB-GYNs is this high, that means that many OB-GYNs are going to have to leave this area in order to make a decent salary. Do you, Senator, Congressman, Mayor, want that to happen in your town? In other words, you don't have to stop delivering a baby to actually make the argument that you might be forced to leave the area, and then how will there be any babies? You don't actually have to pinch any patients to make that argument at all. I think it's a good argument. I think it's a worthy argument. I just don't think you should pinch patients to prove it. You shouldn't let somebody's baby be coming down the canal saying, see how you like it when there's nobody to be there to catch the baby? Instead, you say, imagine what it would be like if there was nobody there to catch the baby. So that's what I mean by legislative action. In fact, that's a lot of what happened. Not because people in Nevada got scared, had the crap scared out of them, because there was no doctor there, but because physicians with those bodies went to the legislator and to other bodies and said, you need to think about the long-term implications and how are we going to solve this. All right, questions from you. That's the argument. Let's see, my memory is they went out for a day. I think they went out for a day. And then, so the thing is, here's what you, I mean, now we're not in the realm of deontology, we're in the realm of practical, more of a consequentialist argument. What you really need in order to create change in something like malpractice or get jury results under control, like a cap of how much damage. So instead of a, $10 million, maybe there's a cap on a $1 million, or, some kind of scale of tort reform, that kind of thing. What you need to actually convince the powers that be that this is a good thing to do is that the public is actually on your side. Because otherwise, you're actually thwarting your own cause. So it became pretty clear pretty fast that this mechanism of let's pinch the public to see if then they'll start calling their congressman wasn't actually as strategically valuable as just let's appeal to the good nature of the public and how much they want us here to have them go to the legislator. So it ended up being the case that this wasn't really playing that well for them. A statewide strike. Now it's interesting too because it just because they called for a statewide strike didn't mean that they did it. I mean, for example, I'm part of go to a pediatric practice that has five clinicians. Not one of the five. They took a very strong stand. They were absolutely not participating in the work stoppage, in the strike in New Jersey. So a lot of doctors actually didn't go out. In fact, the vast majority didn't go out on strike at all. Because, look, there was a reason why the AMA and the American College of Physicians thought it wasn't a morally good thing to do. Their rank and file mostly didn't think it was a good thing to do either. So it actually ended up, this is more of a theoretical argument than one that had more than anecdotal real, instances in the world.
Don't you think part of it, I mean, having kind of like been paying attention to it, I mean, a tremendous amount of it was centered on tort reform and also insurance regulation
yes.
at the time, because those were the two big issues.
Yep.
And as much as you're talking about it from the physician, which I totally understand, because when you're doing a strike, that's still what it comes down to. But those were really the issues, I think, that were at hand. And I think that was the point, was to more or less, shift focus to that. And also, you mentioned the fact that there was a little bit of a calculus effect. It was the rate of rise of malpractice.
Right.
Rates.
It wasn't was going up unbelievably.
Mm-hmm. And so while you were talking right. about the fact that they may have gone up to 130,000, but I think it was also that if we don't put the brakes on this,
people might have more malpractice debt than income. I mean, it could get so crazy.
So
yeah.
While, I completely follow all of your argument, et cetera, having looked back, I think there was at least, it's almost like the whole concept that we're having right now with Occupy Wall Street. If nothing else, it's bringing it to the public eye, and I think this was not the right way to do it.
And you're right, they had to bring it to the public eye. What they could not do is...
I'm presenting a little bit of a counter-argument there in terms of at least part of the rationale for... I don't think they chose the right way to do it, but I'm saying
right.
that was part of the rationale, which I think you didn't necessarily acknowledge per se, but I do think that...
So it's captured, because I don't think... It sounds to me like a friendly amendment, which I absolutely accept. Tell me, we both agree that it had to get in the public's eye. We both agree that physician strikes weren't a good way to get it in. What was the piece that you think that could have been amplified more? There's no doubt about it. They needed tort reform. They needed jury caps. Which is the part that you think should have been brought out more strongly or was omitted and shouldn't have been?
One of the things you said was strikes are motivated by pure self-interest, profits, and income. That was one of the
So tell me, so...
Because the strikes were motivated by a desire to try to bring this very critical issue to the public as well, that if there was not some way in which tort reform could be evaluated and insurance regulation could at least be considered, that... this was one of the consequences that was going to happen. Again, I don't think this was the right way to do it.
I totally get that.
But that was one of your points that you made, that it was by pure self-interest, and I disagree, because I don't think that really was the only thing.
So tell me how tort reform isn't just one step removed from income. Isn't it still self-interest? Tell me how it has more of a social benefit than the benefit of the interest. So pure self-interest means it's not something moral. It's not something I owe to other people or even something that I'm obligated to do for myself, like protect my own life. Pure self-interest means it's about my needs and my interests.
I think it's about, in a way, though, what has happened with medical care and the tendency in this country to look to absolute liability, that it's created a great amount of expense in this country.
Oh, okay. I see.
So it's a societal benefit to
because it expands
beyond just, compensation to physicians. It expands to
waste and healthcare and who can't get insurance,
the way
all of it, yeah, okay, okay.
So
okay,
that was right. one of my major arguments,
okay.
one of the things
good.
That said.
Okay, so let's think about three possible motivations, or let's even just break it down to two. There might be the motivation to benefit society, and this not being a good means, perhaps we're in agreement, but that there is a motive of trying to do good for society, either locally or more globally, nationally. That could be one motive. And the other could be, hey, how's my pocketbook getting affected? And what you're arguing is that there were people who were seriously considering strikes, or at least very much concerned about this issue, who were really motivated at least by both motives, and sometimes simply by one motive, the motive that we have to take care of this, or the whole system's going to collapse, and there's going to be actually societal ill here, serious crisis in our healthcare delivery that I'm not really looking out for numero uno. I'm actually worried about the society.
Some of which has actually gone on to occur.
Yes. So let me absolutely agree with you. In fact, by giving you a more extreme case of physicians striking for clearly non-self-interested motives, and I think it looks a lot different. I do actually. So if, let's imagine that these are the strikers who are striking for pure pocketbook. And these are the strikers who are worried that if we don't get this under control, more people will be uninsured. It's not about me. I'm fine with my income. This is the group of strikers who's striking because if we don't get a hold of this now, patients are going to really be damaged. Patients, especially in access and care. These are the ones working on the pocketbook, and these are the ones who are the social good. I think this group looks a whole lot different than this group. So let me give you a more extreme case of how slam dunk there was a strike that was not about pocketbook and was all about the social. And I actually think I could be talked into the moral permissibility of that strike. So I will take your challenge and I will even up the ante and magnify your point. In Chicago, there was a strike where residents went out in one of the hospitals connected to the University of Chicago because they said, we don't have the kind of nursing staff, the kind of equipment, the kind of infrastructure to actually avoid harming patients. There are not enough resources being put into this hospital to serve patients adequately. We don't have syringes. We don't have enough medicines. We don't have enough nursing staff. This hospital is in absolute crisis, and patients are getting harmed because forget my little resident income. I don't have any income. I got my $40,000. I'm not talking about me. I'm talking about that this hospital doesn't have enough investment to actually give us the tools to treat people, not my income, the actual stuff in the hospital to treat people well. And so we're walking out for a day to make sure that the leaders of this hospital understand they have got to get more nurses, they have got to get more equipment, they have got to have more safety checks, all of that. I actually think that's a fairly noble reason for a strike. I don't think my argument can argue against that. If that's really the only way that they could do better for patients, that was the only way, I think that might actually trump a lot of what I'm arguing. So if the reason why Dr. Susan struck in this case was because she was worried that some people aren't going to have access to health insurance because we're getting to a point where this is only the only people that can afford care are the rich because it's all going to drive the system like that, I actually think Dr. Susan isn't vulnerable to the critique here. So in other words, this argument stipulates, if it's not out of pure self-interest, this argument doesn't even address it. So the idea that you strike because you're trying to really safeguard patients, either in the Chicago case or in the more global healthcare system, tort reform sense, I don't actually think those people are vulnerable to my critique. I'm talking about these people. So I can actually put a parameter around this argument and say, if that's the only way to do it, then I think there might be a rationale. Because let's imagine that you were talking to those patients in the Chicago hospital, and you said, look, it's gonna be a little bit tight. You're gonna have to wait a day or two for this or that. This is how we're gonna protect you. This is why we're doing it. We're doing it because you don't have the nursing care you need, or you don't have the equipment that we need to treat you. We are gonna do this to make a point, but we're doing it for you. My guess is a lot of people would be like, wow, that is so great. If that's patients' reaction, you're not pinching them at all. If, for example, in the New Jersey situation, if that guy Rigoloso had come out and he had said, New Jersey, there are 10 million people in New Jersey who can't afford health insurance. If we let this spiral like this, there's gonna be 20 million. Bond together with me, let's do a work stoppage for a day or two so that we can make people understand that if we don't get this under control, here are the consequences to you. People would probably have been like, all right, you know what, doc, you go ahead. I'm with you on that. It would have been a very different strike. So I can totally agree with you. And even if the strike was the only way, I can even say, you know what, I could even grant them that. I actually think what the Chicago doctors did was pretty darn noble, in a way. So here I am, arguing about strikes. I'm arguing about strikes based on pure self-interest. If it has to do with the social good, well, we're in a totally different place. Because for one thing, you've got actually patients on board with you. Well, now you're not pinching them. If I'm supporting you in the picket line, I'm not actually being pinched. I don't see it that way. And you haven't lost my respect, you've gained my respect. And I don't feel abandoned, I feel like you're trying to protect me. So I think it's a wonderful rejoinder, and I'm just happy to add it as a friendly amendment. All right, let's table it here, and I will see you in a week. Great. Unless there were other objections? All right, then let's...